Hello, everyone. My name is Louisa Morse. I am the Division Chair of STR, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to this symposium on strategic human capital research. At STR, we're running several symposia, and some of these are very popular, and therefore they've been recurring, and that includes actually this one on strategic human capital research. This year, we're also running a series on impact and relevance, hence my background. So please keep an eye on the STR homepage or social media for advertisements of our next events. I'm sure that it's going to be a very interesting conversation today, and thank you very much to all the panelists, the discussants, for being here and participating, and also to Philip Meyer-Doyle, of course, for organizing this session. I will now hand over to Philip to introduce the event and also the speakers of today.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Louise, and welcome everybody to the AOM-STR Virtual Symposium on Strategic Human Capital Research. I'm Philip Meyer-Doyle. I'm on the Executive Committee of the AOM-STR Division, and happy to, of course, have organized this event. And I think we've got very, very interesting research being presented today, and of course, also interesting discussion of that today. So let me kind of very briefly talk about who you're going to hear speak today before we start with the order. You will also hear Federica Di Stefano, who is an assistant professor of management and human resources at HEC Paris. You will hear Tomasz Theodorycz present his work today. He's an assistant professor of strategy and innovation at Copenhagen Business School. And of course, also Xinjie Wang, who is an assistant professor in the School of Labor and Employment Relations at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And we also have got two fantastic discussants, Vanessa Bobano, the Sydney Terrell Associate Professor of Business at Columbia Business School, and of course, Seth Carnahan, Associate Professor of Strategy at the Olin Business School at the Washington University in St. Louis. So in terms of the order, in terms of the agenda, each of the presenters, the researchers are going to have about 12 minutes to present their research, their latest research on, of course, in the domain of strategic human capital. And then we have two discussants who've obviously been receiving the papers and read the papers carefully to provide their feedback on the work presented. Also roughly 12 minutes each. And of course, at the end, there's time. There's also, of course, the opportunity for any of the audience members to ask any questions and provide any feedback. Okay, so without further ado, let's hear and hand over to my colleague, Federica.
Just share my screen. Are you all able to see it? All right. So, hello everyone. Thank you so much, Philip, for organizing this symposium and for having me. It's really a privilege to be able to present my work. The paper I'm presenting today is joint work with Matthew Bidwell, and it's a paper in which I focus on studying careers in project-based organizations. So what I really try to understand in this paper is how people accumulate human capital and how they advance in these types of firms. And when I talk about project-based organizations, what I mean are those organizations such as law firms or services firms in which work is really organized around projects. This paper really starts from my interest in studying careers in contexts in which organizations seek flexibility, and in particular in different organizational forms that try to attain such flexibility. Traditionally, the work on careers has defined careers as evolving sequences of work experience over time. And a large body of work has conceptualized these sequences as sequences of jobs. Jobs have been used as the most granular unit of analysis to understand what people do and who they work with. And somehow the characteristics of lower level jobs have been used to predict the characteristics of the destination jobs in which people are promoted. However, this project starts from the remark that in many organizations, work is not organized around jobs necessarily, but is often organized around projects. So in these organizations, jobs are mostly defining hierarchical levels and are instead very broad in terms of what type of work people within the same job titles perform. And instead, it's the project that people are staffed to that really defines what people are doing and their network of collaborators. So the key idea that we are pushing in this paper is that there is reason to believe that project-based careers are systematically different from job-based ones. In particular, we argue here that they are different because people have a much broader scope for experimentation and flexibility to try different types of work and to collaborate with different types of people. In particular, this flexibility has two drivers. The first is that projects are much more bounded in time, have a shorter duration than jobs, so that while in the same level, people can actually at the same time experiment with more types of work and more types of people. And projects are also more bounded in scope, meaning that for both the employer and employee, experimenting via being assigned to different projects is much less of a commitment than experimenting by formal transfers across jobs. So the idea of this paper is trying to understand if this intuition that the returns from experimentations in project-based careers are different or somehow yield different advantages to workers who engage in that. However, while this experimentation potential and scope is available, how this works in practice and the extent to which employees use that is not fully documented. There is a large body of work on job variety and the returns from job variety that suggests mixed evidence and mixed theoretical arguments for the benefits and the cons of specialization vis-a-vis more diverse and broad portfolios of experience. However, the extent to which these arguments on whether people should become specialists or diversify their portfolio of experiences is not fully extended to the domain of project-based careers. A lot of the work on project-based careers focus on external labor markets, so doesn't focus on careers within organizations. And somehow, there is it's not clear how the fact that shifts across projects are less discontinuous than shifts across jobs plays out in determining whether it's better for people to have broad experiences versus more specialized ones. And this is a phenomenon that is empirically not fully documented, at least in a quantitative manner, whereas most of the project-based work is quantitatively documented, as I mentioned, in the context of external labor markets. And this is really the type of empirical documentation and investigation that we want to do in this study by addressing the question of what is the relationship between project variety and promotions within organizations. So is it better to have diversified project portfolios working on IT, human capital, marketing with very diverse people, or is it better to specialize? We address these questions using a unique data set that we constructed, collecting data from a project-based services organizations. We collected data for the U.S. workforce of this company for over 40,000 employees from 2010 to 2018. And we merged information on how many hours are associated with each project and allocated with each project, where projects are defined by a billing code that entails different collaborators and different content of the work that is performed. And we combine this information with HR personnel data and with some complementary qualitative interviews. In order to understand the relationship between project variety and promotions, we measure project variety using an entropy index, which is somehow a an advisable measure for measuring diversity in terms of knowledge categories. We fundamentally use this index, which is a measure of the extent to which the hours that are allocated to the projects are very concentrated across like few items or very dispersed across multiple items. And this index ranges from zero, which is a maximum level of concentration, so specialization, to the logarithm of the number of the items. Importantly, we measure variety along two dimensions. We measure variety in terms of content of the work that people perform, so areas and domains of knowledge, human capital. And then we measure variety in terms of the collaborators, so in terms of social capital, do they work with a wide array of collaborators? We measure the extent to which these employees accumulate the variety of experience from the day of a hire until the focal point in time. And as you can see in this histogram, so we observe in our data a certain degree of variation in how people choose to accumulate diversity in content and collaborators. And the two measures are correlated in the order of 30%. We then relate this measure of these two measures of variety to the promotion in the following year. The first step in our investigation is estimating a series of linear probability models relating the cumulative variety in year T to the promotion in year T plus one. So in our models, we control for a number of fixed effects because, and notably the ones that I would like to point out are really the fixed effects through which we try to control for the heterogeneity in opportunity to be promoted. So in particular, the hiring year, the title, business line, and region at the time of hire, as well as a matching indicator for the title, business line, and region at the focal time. Importantly, assuming that the negative effects of reverse causality and of the selection into diversification should play a role that is stronger for most recent experience, we include in our analysis not only the cumulative longer term diversity, but also a measure of a shorter term variety to measure how to basically explore this tension between shorter term experience that should be more affected by reverse causality issues and by the selection of lower performance into being more dispersed and the longer term effects of a variety of experience accumulation. And this is why in our tables, you see both results for the cumulative variety for both content and collaborators, and for the within a year, more recent variety for both content and collaborators. In model one, you can see that the relationship of the cumulative content variety to promotion in the following year is positive and significant. While consistent with the argument that more recent experience variety reflects more strongly the endogeneity concerns of selection, we do find a negative effect of the within year variety. In column two, we estimate the values, the effects of collaborator variety, and we find consistent results, both in terms of the cumulative variety of collaborators and of the within year one. In models 3 and 4, you can see a saturated model with different types of fixed effects, as well as the interaction between the two indices of variety. And we do find that there is a substitution effect with the returns from diversifying in content being the highest for the people who have less of a diverse network of collaborators. And just to give you a sense of the economic size of these effects, we find that a one standard deviation increase in variety on both dimensions leads to a 1% increase in the probability of promotions in the following year. And again, these are linear probability models that we select for ease of interpretability. We conduct a number of robustness checks, but the one that I like to stress for the sake of time, is really our attempt at addressing further the endogeneity issues related to relating the variety of experience to promotions. To this goal, we, among our analysis, we conduct a series of analyses based on an instrumental variable approach. We try to construct an instrument of the actual portfolio, the actual dispersion of people's hours, which based on the demand for hours by clients. So we estimate the demand for hours by clients for the types of work that people do based on the hours that everyone else who is working on those clients will work in the following year. So if you see two employees and they are both working in year T on projects X and Z, with employee A working 10 hours on X and 10 hours on Z, and employee B working 15 hours on each project, we know that in year T plus one, employee B is going to work 20 hours in X. And so we are going to basically use this information about what employees B is doing in T plus one to construct a predicted fictitious portfolio of hours for our focal employee. We also include a number of controls to address many of the concerns that are related to these instruments, and I'd love to hear more and discuss this further in the Q&A. For the sake of time, I'm trying to be fast on this. But this instrument is really trying at getting an hour distribution that is not driven by the same characteristics of the employee that would also lead to their potential for promotability. And our results in this two-stage least square estimation are consistent with our linear probability baseline basic models. So we do find in column four, where we present the second stage of our analysis, we do find a positive relationship between a significant relationship between content entropy and the likelihood of being promoted in the following year, as well as a positive relationship between collaborator entropy and the likelihood of being promoted in the following year. Similarly to the previous results, we also find that the two act as substitutes, so that somehow they can pull, people can either diversify through content or through collaborators. We conduct a number of other robustness analyses to really get at how variety in collaborators at different hierarchical levels, as well as how exits and compensation effects function in this setting. And I'm happy to talk more about those in the Q&A. So with this work, we basically hope to contribute to an understanding of careers in project-based organization, so in a different type of firm. We hope to contribute to two streams of work. The first is the literature on specialization and careers by somehow assessing the returns from breadth and experimentation when careers are not job-based, and so when there is much broader scope for crafting career paths within the organizations. And we also hope to provide some contribution by trying to separate the variety and breadth in terms of human capital and social capital. We also hope to document, to our knowledge, for one of the first times, project-based careers within the firms rather than in external labor market. And in so doing, we hope to contribute to the literature on project-based work more broadly. From a managerial standpoint, we really hope that this paper can help project-based organizations in career planning and staffing and resource allocation optimization for the growth and development of their employees. And with that, I would like to thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Federica. Very, very interesting paper. Let me now hand over to Vanessa for her discussion.
Thank you, Frederica's paper, another really interesting paper that I really enjoyed reading. My interpretation of their question here is, how does diversification in the kinds of projects an employee works on and the collaborators that they work with and these interactions affect employee promotion? And the answer shown in this paper is that essentially, like, diversification on each of these dimensions means more promotion, faster promotion, and that these effects kind of offset each other such that they're substitutes in a way. Also, a lot to like about this paper, I think it's a really kind of unique and interesting data set that you have access to with it, like this kind of really granular employee project level data within this company. So I think that that's really, I love seeing like new data. So I think that that's really exciting. I appreciated sort of the attention you paid to causality in the writing of your paper and discussion of your paper. And I think that these nonlinear effects that you find are quite interesting. So some comments and suggestions to hopefully be helpful as you're sort of working on pushing the paper further forward. In terms of the intro and theory development, so you did this in your presentation, but in the paper, I think just earlier examples of like what are project-based organizations. I realized later you're talking about like consulting firms and law firms and things like that. And that became clear later on in reading the paper. But at the beginning, I was sort of wondering, there's this big emphasis on project-based organizations, but like, what is a project-based organization? I think, and this is also something that I think was a little clearer to me in your presentation than in the paper, which is like, what is it about what the existing work tells us and what we don't know about project-based work specifically? So you reference sort of a few different literature streams, like the generalist versus specialist literature. And I think in your presentation today, it was a little clearer to me that I think the key distinction is that this literature has looked at generalist versus specialist across jobs as opposed to within projects within the same company. But just sort of making a clear link for the reader in terms of, okay, well, so what is it about being project-based and not across job switching that is different and that might lead us to think that what we know from this generalist versus specialist literature may not apply here. And again, I think this was clear to me in your presentation right now, but maybe in the revision of the paper, you could pay more attention to that. And this was a similar comment, right? You also referenced research on specialized job sequences, which, you know, has sort of predicted the things that we would predict in terms of social networks. But so, you know, just help the reader understand, like, how are projects different from kind of the quote-unquote kinds of work that this literature has focused on, and why might we think it would work differently? These, again, you know, in the talk, I wouldn't have had this comment, but in reading the version of the paper, I did, which is that you have a lot of like terms in the paper, and just some more clarity about or perhaps more consistent usage of terms, I think would be helpful because you say things like the job they occupy, and I was like, well, you know, is that the job? Is that the hierarchical title? Is that the occupation that they're in? The tasks that they're doing, you sort of meant a lot of these terms come up. So job they occupy, formal job description, projects they perform, just really kind of clarity of sort of, you know, this is what I'm looking at, or is the kind of the project level, and this is why these other categorizations or levels are not that, and why it's important. Oh, and so this was also just a question that I had in reading your theory development, which is that in making this argument that variety and project type and sort of set of collaborators will lead to increased promotions. So is it because these things increase their productivity and performance on their current job, and then that just increases the chances that they get promoted? Or is it that the people deciding on who gets promoted are taking into account how project variation and collaboration variation is going to likely affect their ability to do the higher level jobs? I think it's the second. The way you were describing H2 was very clearly to me to the second. H1 was a little bit of a mix of the two, and so I would just be clear about the argument you're making. And I think if it's the latter argument, I'm happy to send you this paper. This is a kind of really unrelated context, but I have a paper looking at pro bono as an employee kind of signaling mechanism that argues that the firm basically looks at signals of what it is that an employee is likely to do in stretch roles and like a next level job. So if it's the second one, I'm happy to send you this, as that might be somewhat relevant. So some suggestions about the empirics. I would have loved just more examples and explanations of your key variables, like what are service types? Like a few examples of what that means. I think a full list in an appendix of these service types would perhaps be helpful. These content entropy and collaborator entropy measures, can you like provide the distribution of these variables? Maybe an example of what it means to be in like the top decile or top quartile or something like that. Just sort of more details, more examples, because the measures are a little bit hard to wrap your head around in terms of like what exactly they are measuring and thus how to, you know, how we should interpret the results. I thought that maybe one robustness test you could run is, are your re results robust to using just service type or rather than and client for your collaborator entropy measure? Because it wasn't necessarily clear to me that they would have had to be on the same service type and the same client to be needing to talk to each other at work, right? You could imagine, like, if we're doing the same service type job and I'm a consultant, I probably talk to people who are doing the same project type, but for a different client. So just an idea for a robustness test you could run there. I don't know if this is baked into your entropy measures because I think more detail on them would have made this clearer for me, but since I wasn't entirely sure if this was baked into that, perhaps adding as a control the total number of projects that they're working on would be helpful in your analyses. So I actually really like the way you presented the series of analyses in your presentation with today, which is to show us not the IV first and then show the IV as a robustness check, as opposed to the paper is written as like, we found this amazing IV that solves all the problems of causality. And I think you have to do a little bit more to convince the reader about the IV. So I like the way you're presenting it today in terms of here's kind of just some non-IV results with controls and fixed effects, et cetera. We're doing what we can to control for endogeneity. And here's this other thing that we ran, which is an IV, but it'll kind of like limit, it'll lower a little bit the kind of like attention you'll get on the IV, the way you presented it today versus the way it is in the paper. And I think, you know, for the IV, what exactly the instrument is a little bit confusing and hard to wrap your head around. So I kind of like understand what the concept is that you're trying to get at here. But the exact measurement of it and what it is you're getting and whether this is like a true measure of demand, anticipated demand, I think it just needs a little bit more work to convince the reader. One thing that came to my mind, and maybe there's other IVs that have done this, but you know, using like a prediction, I just had a hard time wrapping my head around how a variable using a prediction is exogenous, right? Like it's kind of like we're saying we can predict this value, but it's an exogenous shock. And so again, maybe this is a language thing, or this is my lack of familiarity with other IVs that have done similar things. But if that's the case, maybe pointing to other examples or something like that would be helpful. And then for me, the biggest thing for the IV, I think that you have to think about ruling out for the reader is, you know, isn't it likely that employee productivity or performance is going to drive both client demand for project types and promotion likelihood? For me, that's like the hardest kind of like assumption we have to wrap our head around to kind of believe the validity of the IV. Another thing that I found really interesting in your paper, and this is kind of like similar to my comment to Philip, which is a couple things that I think are run almost as like robustness checks, but have different effects and therefore are almost like more interesting than just kind of like, oh, you know, here's the findings that don't always replicate for these other variables, is you have these different effects on promotion versus compensation versus exit. And I think that that's interesting. So like, help us interpret that. You know, does that help us tell us something about mechanism, or something else, or help us rule in something or rule out something else? The other thing that I thought about was because you had done these qualitative interviews and you clearly have kind of this access to this company, which I think is a big benefit for this paper, is can you conduct like some interviews about the promotion requirements or process or considerations? Again, just to kind of help us regarding this kind of mechanism you're proposing, if it's a signaling mechanism or if it's a, you know, some other mechanism. I think some of these kind of quotes could help in giving color to that and kind of helping us believe that this is what's going on in this context. And that's it for me. Thanks again for the chance to read these really interesting papers. And I look forward to seeing them published in print one day soon, hopefully.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Vanessa. Fantastic.
Thanks so
comments.
Much.
All right. Next, we have Tomas.
Okay. Let's see if I learn how to share my screen appropriately. In 1 second. Swap. Okay. Can you see my screen? The correct screen? Perfect. I learned it. So we had a little issue on my end before. So first of all, thank you so much, Philip, for inviting me to present, and thank you also to Vanessa, Seth, Federica, and Shinjay for being here, and to everyone. It's always nice to see like familiar names and faces on Zoom. So the paper that I'm presenting is currently going under a major review process. So the name is likely changed, Seth. It's the same paper, different name, and that is a part of the reframing, the major reframing that I'm engaging, but the analysis, this is the main analysis, remain the same. So the current title, which is still it's still not fully defined, is called Chain Ownership and Human Capital Reconfiguration in Social Services: Evidence from Acquisitions in Private Higher Education. So this project mainly expands my research agenda on learning organizations. So the study of firms that provide education as a service, and what is the human capital. How does human capital play a role within these firms? So the main motivation of this paper starts with this idea that both society and organizations, they face many challenges that require the ability to increase access to social services. And social services, we can think broadly construed as healthcare services, water, sanitation, and educational services. And if we focus on the context of education, we see the World Economic Forum saying, well, with AI and automation, we have hundreds of millions of workers that need reskilling. Where do we start? We also see the private sector, McKinsey, are saying like 87% of companies say that they have skills gap or expect within a few years to have that. And if we go even to a more rudimentary view on increasing access to social services, we think about access to higher education. So how can we increase access to higher education and provide individuals the skills that they need to thrive in the future? And amongst many solutions we have considered for increasing access, one potential solution is to promote the growth of chain organizations, so promote chain ownership. So essentially having a few firms that work as business units that owns, leases, or controls a group of two or more facilities. And the reason this could be a potential solution is that if you have a higher education institution within the chain, that institution can leverage the same resources and synergies and actually try to expand their services at a cost-efficient way across multiple establishments, and in this way recruit more students, somewhat standardized quality, so no establishment is left behind. And even when you think abstract away from social services, you see that chain ownership can enable firms to increase their geographic and market scope in many sectors. So we see IKEA that owns multiple establishments in the world deploying the same store design in a way that's efficient for customers to engage with it and they create value. We also see consulting firms as the ones that Federico was studying, that they create the single resource on like a post-merger integration handbook that can be deployed across their multiple establishments. Even in healthcare, we see that the World Health Organization, they try to standardize, and if they develop, they provide this knowledge to the private sector, they can actually have this one firm scaling its knowledge on how to provide healthcare services, let's say in Africa, in a more cost-efficient way within the single structure. And also how to manage this growth is just a foundational topic in strategic management. We've been talking about managing the growth of a single firm ever since Penrose. We go through Chandler, and more recently we have been studying how can actually organizations deploy and redeploy resources as they manage growth across different geographies and markets. In this project, the focus is this contrast between value creation within chain organization, but also some stakeholder tensions that emerge in social services. So if you go about chain ownership in social services, we have some which is Ethan et al. Excuse me? Oh, sorry. We have chain ownership in education and healthcare services, showing this ways in which chain ownership can actually create value to beneficiaries bringing several increased access, but there are also some trade-offs within the group of consumers associated to the reduction in quality. And this paper tries to expand this lecture by, instead of focusing on trade-offs within the group of customers, such as cost quality trade-off, focusing on distension of stakeholder distension that emerges across stakeholders. So beneficiaries having their value increased by expanding access, but also some elements of resource reconfiguration that can affect a different type of stakeholder within the organization, which is the employee. So the idea of the paper is see how the chain ownership in education will drive a tension between creating value to beneficiaries and also affecting how employees get managed, and that is due to the resource reconfiguration incentives. And then for now, let's think about our human capital, since we're focusing on education. Our human capital is comprised of multiple knowledge and skills that we have. Like Philippe has a great presentation skills and networking skills and research skills, and all that constitutes his human capital. That's how he creates value to INSEAD. But imagine now that INSEAD was actually a chain ownership, a chain organization, and starts acquiring multiple firms and really trying to standardize its learning instead of just having, you know, really leveraging the unique human capital that Philippe has. The question is, as chain ownership enables this replication of practices and standardization of courseware, what will happen to how the organization creates a relationship with workers and deploys workers, and what is the strategic value of Philippe's human capital within the organization that he works at? The context that I'm going to study is that of expansion of private firms in Brazilian private higher education. So just so you get a sense of it, in 2020, there were 4 million undergraduate students in private higher education in Brazil. I live in Denmark. That's 75% also of Danish population. So it's a pretty large sector, so to speak. So if you believe in any of those works using large Danish data for the economy, think that this is the population of students that I have in this context. And ever since 1997, there was a recent expansion of private higher education that I'm also studying in different papers with Ilse Kivlinisi from INSEAD and Carlos and Deepak Sumaya from Illinois, on what are the different strategies that private firms use to expand in this market. And one particular strategy that we saw was this emergence of 14 quote-unquote educational groups, which is how they're called in Brazil, which essentially they are chain owners. So they are large corporations that own multiple establishments in the country. And they have this focus on rapid growth, replication of managerial practices, and search for economies and resource utilization. And they joke that this expansion in Brazil was so important that it even made the economist. And it's rare for Brazil to make the economist. So it's a setting that I treasure. And what's interesting is that these chain organizations, they really expanded via acquisitions. So if you see their growth from 2006 to 2014, most of the establishments owned by these chain organizations, they came through via acquisitions. So organic growth was fairly let's say parallel over time, and all the growth came via acquisitions. And then I'm going to study what is the effect of being acquired by a chain owner on human capital and value creation to customers. And I use a plethora of data sets, hand-collected data on M&A activities, large public administrative data sets on the census, which has the location, number of students, number of courses, data on university quality, data on formal labor contracts, which is a restricted administrative data set to see how is human capital redeployed, and also in-depth interviews and contextual knowledge to get a sense of how do these chain organizations operate in Brazil. So the main method is going to be a panel event study diff and diff within a matched sample. So I'm going to compare treated firms, which are firms that are acquired by chain owners, to matched firms that were never acquired, so they never change ownership, and that's and we essentially employ methods that are very standard when you want to assess the effects of being acquired by a firm. And I combine that with interviews on characteristics of chain owners, faculty firm relationships, and a battery of robustness tests to see if my interpretations are valid as well. So to get a sense, so the interviews characterize chain owners acquisition strategy. So essentially these educational groups, as they're called in Brazil, they try to achieve rapid growth to cater to larger market segments. So they will try to obtain scale, both by bringing in new students, but also by transferring degrees across establishments to increase diversity of product offering across multiple regions. They also try to replicate a teaching-oriented business model. So we're not talking about, you know, the Harvards or MITs or HSCs of the world. We're talking about teaching-oriented colleges mainly, and really try to standardize pedagogical and managerial resources so that they can leverage, for instance, course material the fullest. And they also try to obtain economies of scale by intensifying the use of faculty and of other scale-free resources. And they have like some quotes here, which particularly the one that I like is this idea that faculty had access to class plans that define which content had to be covered at every time window in the class, and the time window in this case was like 5 minutes. So it was really well structured, and all faculty was expected to follow this plan. So to the results. So what happened when chain owners acquired firms? So first of all, you really do see some value creation to potential value creation to beneficiaries, as there is an increase in the diversity of services offered. So there's an increase in the count of in-person degrees offered. There's also an increase in the share of students in hybrid in-person courses. So colleges, once they get acquired by chain firms, they provide not only in-person services, but also hybrid services that combine remote to in-person. Then not only that, you also see some value in terms of economies in human capital utilization per student. So you see the enrollment to faculty hour ratio goes up over time after the acquisition. And it's important to notice that there are no changes in the quality indicator. So you really do see an increase in efficiency without a decrease in quality, and then have a better robustness test showing that. And we also see an increase in access to higher education service. So you really do see some elements in which these chain owners create value, both to customers and also to employees in their productivity, such as hourly wage, for instance, goes up, access goes up, diversity of courses also goes up. These acquisitions, they affected the human capital resources by increasing their productivity. You see the hourly wage, so let's say the average faculty wage for a full-time contract goes up over time. But then you see an interesting pattern that we see this chain owners weakening the value of faculty's human capital as a strategic resource. There is sustainable replacement of faculty. So turnover rate goes up, as you'd expect from an acquisition, but it stays up over time, which denotes the idea that faculty became more replaceable even though they are more productive. And why did this happen? We see that this college started using flexible work arrangements, so essentially denoting that human capital becomes less strategic, at least the human capital of the faculty, and we see that on the weekly number of hours in the labor contract. And you also see lower requirements for experience, so the use of tacit knowledge as a part of the faculty human capital becomes less important. So they start hiring faculty that have less experience as a faculty throughout his career. That I measured this using the measures on the career of each faculty. And then I have a bunch of robustness tests showing that there's no change in quality, brand effects don't affect the results. An interesting fact that the replaceability is related to thickness of the labor market. So thin labor markets, you don't see an increase in replaceability, because even if the faculty teaching standardized courseware, they have no other faculty to hire, so there's no increase in turnover. So replaceability happens in thick labor markets. There's also no single chain owner driving the result, and the changes are not an artifact of acquisitions. So I compare, for instance, acquisitions by chain owners to any other change in ownership, and we see turnover that only goes up for 2 years in other acquisitions and then reverts to the regular levels, whereas acquisitions by chain owners remain over time at a higher turnover level. We also see an interesting element of resource reconfiguration, which is higher likelihood of hiring a professional top manager, so changing which human capital is valuable to organizations over time. And so just two key takeaways to wrap it up. So the first key takeaway, the chain owners lead to a within stakeholder tension. So not only they increase the productivity, but they also increase the replaceability of faculty, so decrease irreplaceability. And how they do that is like they specialize faculty in tasks that require less tacit knowledge, and they change which human capital is valuable towards professional managers. And the second takeaway is cross-stakeholder tension. So chain owners create value to students by having higher access and more diverse set of programs without changing quality, but harm employees, such as in this quote saying that, you know, professors now face virtual classes and they are dismissed via pop-up messages because it's more efficient. And then I have some boundary conditions that I don't think I have time to discuss. Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to hear the comments.
Thank you, Tomas. Very, very interesting paper. I love the visualizations. Over to you, Xinjie.
Okay, let me just share my screen with you. All right, so thank you very much for having me here today to share this work. So this is a joint work with Xinjin Chaitoupeda at University of Illinois and Florence Honoré at University of Wisconsin-Madison. So in this paper, we are looking at this question of the role of academic founders and how they shape the breadth of market entry among the startups. And we're examining this question in the context of AI, which, as many of you would be all aware, that it's having a lot of new developments and has a lot of potential to revolutionize the economy, the market competition, and also the way we work. And this is a nice setting because we are looking at the question of the breadth of market entry. And one important characteristic of AI is its wide range of applicability, ranging from its applicability across various sectors and industries, so horizontally, but also vertically across different function and activities within the farm. So given this context, we look at this question of the role of academic entrepreneurs, and the question of this market entry is an important one for tech startups, as it has a lot of implications for new ventures to secure their funding, as well as leading to various venture outcomes. And studies have found that it's the human capital of the founders that's often shaping these decisions. So the human capital that's been accumulated from their prior experiences. And one important prior experience that we examine in this paper is the founder's academic experience. Within the tech field and also in our context as well, academics have been playing a very important role in shaping the technology and the commercialization of the products. And also we know that academia has strong influence on individual skills and knowledge. So in this paper, we are asking this question of how will academic experience versus non-academic experience will influence the breadth of market entry a new venture might pursue. Given that there isn't a set of cohesive literature that would lead to a clear prediction, we are taking an abductive approach here. So we're starting with our main finding that teams with academic entrepreneurs are likely to have 13% more market applications. And then we go to examine established theories on the type of research that these founders are pursuing, as well as the location in the value chain, and look at whether this can explain our main finding, and we find a minimal support. And from the we turn to the interviews to further find what's explaining this effect, and we talk to different actors and the ecosystem, and we propose an explanation based on these insights from the interviews that it's the founder's problem formulation and solving approach that is driving these differences. And we follow up with quantitative analysis using generality of publications and patents and find that they are explaining our main finding. So since this is an abductive paper, I wanted to jump right in to introduce our empirical strategy, which led to our finding of the positive effect of academic teams. So we merged the data from Crunchbase, LinkedIn, and PitchBook. We got the list of founding teams in AI headquartered in the US with two or more founders. We also looked at the solo founders, but found that they were qualitatively different from these founders in teams. So we focus on this sample. And we merged them with the career history data from LinkedIn, as well as the market breadth, the verticals data from PitchBook. And we ended up with 988 teams with venture-level data as well as full career history data for all founders. And we used the OLS regression for our analysis. So like I mentioned, we got this variable called verticals from PitchBook. It is a variable that's being a measure that's being established. It's been used in the NSF report, And PitchBook is a subsidiary of Morningstar, and they are using this to make these reports for the financial analysts are using these measure as well. So we believe that this measure will gain more traction along the way. And our independent variable is whether the team has an academic entrepreneur. And about 8% of the teams had these academic entrepreneurs. So we define academics as those who have currently or previously holding academic positions as faculty or postdocs or research associates. So all of them are holding PhD degree. And we also control for a host of variables such as team age, size, as well as the human capital characteristics of the founders, and so on. So after finding the positive effect of having the academic founder, we went on to examine whether the past research can explain these findings. And we looked at the two different streams where they look at the type of research and they look at the complementary assets. And the idea is that academics are found to focus more on basic research as opposed to applied research. And their basic knowledge allows them to produce more upstream technologies that has more potential to be sold to various sectors of the economy, leading to more market applications. So that is about how basic research provides them with the opportunity to locate more upstream. And the second set of argument is about how academics lack certain downstream complementary assets. So it's more about the constraint. So this constraint is making them locate upstream. And again, that's leading to more market applications. And we explore whether these explanations can lead to our main finding. So to test the basic versus applied mechanism, we additionally collected data on the publications of our founders from Scopus, and we classify them into basic and applied knowledge. We use ChatGPT to code them as basic or applied after manually coding them among the authors. The 2000 publications, we achieved about 78% accuracy rate. We thought that it was quite good. And we found that academics indeed conduct more basic research, but basic research only explained about 3% of the main effect. And when we examine the location in the ecosystem, whether they're locating upstream or downstream, by examining the patent sales data, patent licensing data, and customer segments and products, we did not find that this location, there is difference in the location. So first of all, patent sales was not associated with verticals, and there was also no record that we found on patent licensing happening, although we were constrained to public companies. And all startups, based on the company descriptions and websites, seem to be overwhelmingly located downstream. So about only 10% of our sample occupied an upstream location, regardless of whether they included an academic entrepreneur or not. Then what is driving our finding, right? So we turn to speaking with the related stakeholders who had academic experiences and non-academic experiences, and also who were involved in startups and who were working in industries and so on. And we made two observations. So first of all, academics are pursuing more general problems that they solve with a scientific method, which provides them with this opportunity to produce a class of solutions in their startups. And non-academics, because of their constraints in terms of time and profitability, while they are working in industry, they tend to identify market pain points and solve them with existing tools and heuristics. So even after they join a startup or found a startup, they come in with the same mindset and they try to identify a clear market within their startups and quickly narrow down. So our explanation is that it's the differences in the problem formulation and solving approach that is leading to these differences in the breadth of market after these individuals found their new ventures. And relatedly, we also, the idea is that if there is a difference between problem formulation and problem solving, this should manifest in some intermediate outcomes. So we explored whether there are differences in terms of the generality of the knowledge that's being produced by these founding teams. And we looked at the generality of publications, looking at how much is cited by other fields, the breadth of the fields that's citing the focal publications, and also similarly with patents, how much of different classes are citing the focal patents of the founding teams. And we found that academic teams' publications and patents were indeed more general. It was associated with more verticals. And our main relationship, once we account for generality, it was fully explained by the generality of knowledge. We also conducted some supplementary findings, which I don't think I have time to go into more detail, but we also looked at some startup outcomes related to these breadth of market entry, although we believe that this is probably also, we have to also think about how our context also would shape this relationship, and we also found some results around some attenuation of the time spent in industry when we looked at teams with non-faculty PhDs. So to summarize, the teams with academics, we find that they're associated with higher number of verticals than teams without, and we find that it's the differences in the problem formulation and solving approach that may lead to these advantages. Some limitations around generalizability, that this is an emerging field, emerging technology, and the ecosystem has certain characteristics that may not generalize to other contexts. We also cannot perfectly disentangle selection from treatment. There may be some differences in people who are pursuing PhD, also who are pursuing these new ventures. So causality should be attributed with caution. And also, we do not directly measure the problem solving and framing and solving approach. So future research can use more direct measures to get closer to testing this mechanism. And finally, we hope to contribute to literature in AI, where we are first finding that the academic startups are also locating downstream. And this may be due to the fact that within this industry, the larger firms are dominating the upstream locations to provide complementary assets. So in this context, then academics with their high control approach can have an advantage to offer. And also to contribute to entrepreneurship, innovation, and strategic human capital literature, our study highlights how prior experience not only shapes the concrete skills and knowledge, but can also shape the cognitions of founders, which also has a potential to affect their behaviors. And also in this study, we're highlighting the unique strength of academic entrepreneurs despite their well-documented weaknesses in the prior research. So I hope I left enough time for Seth, but I'll end here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Xinjie. And absolutely, we of course have enough time for Seth. We may be overrunning by 5 minutes, but that's absolutely fine.
Thanks, everybody. I'm pulling up my slides here. Here we go. So I'm doing the classic thing where you put your face in the slides to kind of bring everybody in. And my head is so large it's chopping off the top of my head. So I'll move my camera a little bit. Okay. So good morning, afternoon, evening, wherever you might be around the world. It's great to see everybody, and it's such a pleasure to discuss these two wonderful papers by scholars that I've known for quite a long time and really respect. And I'll keep my comments short. I was telling Philip in the chat that I only have 10 slides, and he was like, "Oh, 10 actually sounds like a lot." So I can go fast. And I mean, the key thing here is that these are both very mature papers, and I think that they're probably in advanced stage of the review process. So I don't really want to give the authors, you know, comments that might lead them in other directions. And I just want to encourage them to focus on what the reviewers and editors are telling them. And then hopefully whatever I say can help support that. And also I want to say to the authors, if they want any help dealing with comments from editors or reviewers, or if they have any specific questions for me, I'd be happy to converse by email or set up a Zoom chat to discuss. So first, I'll talk about the paper that Xinjie discussed and is co-authored with Xinjie and Florence, scholars all of whom I have known and respect very much. So why will you cite this paper? So I can see this paper being cited for its findings about academic entrepreneurs. So I look forward to seeing these kinds of sentences in future papers. Like, academic founders tend to develop products and technologies that are more general and thus more applicable to multiple market segments. And, you know, I have 2025 here because that's I'm thinking that's when the paper will appear in print. So I imagine this is what kind of the building block, the contribution the paper is making to the literature. So why else might you cite this paper? I think it does a really nice job of giving a template for abductive methodology. And this is something that SMJ is pushing on more and more. And I personally am not, I've never written an abductive paper, and I hear this word thrown around a lot, but I don't have a good sense of how to do it. And if you're interested in doing this kind of work, I would look at Xinjie's paper. They do a really nice job of kind of walking through the method, and I thought this was just a great table to explain how they go through this process of inference to the best explanation, which Tomáš also mentioned in his paper. So I want to just pin that for everybody. If you are interested in this kind of abductive stuff, ask Xinjie for a copy of her paper and use it as a template, which templates are a way for me, the way I always learn. So thank you for this, folks. I bet your paper will get cited for the method quite a bit. So what would I say? What's my main, just kind of like modular recommendation, I would say? The thing that I wanted in the paper, especially reading through the introduction, I think you can increase the impact of the paper by selling the importance of entering into multiple market segments and explaining how academics do it differently. So really right now it's kind of paper says multiple market segments are important and then moves on. And I wanted more emphasis on why this is an issue, more than just like we haven't studied this before and it's a gap in the literature. I wanted to kind of some meat on that bone about why we should be excited about this outcome and how and why it's important to understand it, especially with this phenomenon-driven paper. And so something I was trying to think about was, okay, research tends to cast market entry as hard work. So this paper by Olaf Sorensen in 2000 and SMJ talks about how firms have to very carefully prune and work on managing their product portfolios and so on. And what I'm wondering is, what do you envision academics doing? I mean, my sense is, you're not too explicit about this, but I think what you're saying is that academics create these general technologies that are then very low cost and require very little customization to then spread into multiple market segments. And if that's kind of what you have in mind, I'd be more explicit about it perhaps and try to explain like why that's interesting and important, you know, lowering the costs, academic knowledge, lowering the cost of firms' product diversification, I think is interesting. I know you can't measure the cost of diversification and the, you know, the complexity and the difficulty and of managing and so on, but even just kind of like marbling that in there a little bit as a as kind of a teaser or an explanation in the introduction, I think would be a way to get people excited about figuring out what's going on in your context. And maybe you have some qualitative data about this that you could use to kind of push on this, like lowering the costs of a complex product portfolio. Okay, so moving to Tomáš's paper, this is great. So it's, I love the changes that Tomáš has made to the paper since the version I read and what he presented today. My recommendations are going to be kind of in this vein, so in the same vein of the changes he's already made. So Tomáš, I think you're looking great. And if you want to talk to me more about that as you go through this big overhaul, you know, feel free to email me or we can set up a time to chat. So what I think, why will you cite this paper? I think you'll cite this paper for its really interesting combination of findings. So when large for-profit firms acquire higher education institutions, market share increases, productivity increases, wages increase, but turnover goes way up and worker experience goes way down. So it's this interesting kind of pushing on productivity, pushing on these kind of customer-facing outcomes, but then also making workers more replaceable while also having higher wages. So it's just an interesting mixture of findings that I think could be framed in many different ways. And I think that I can tell Tomáš is trying to find the right kind of frame there, and I give my two cents on maybe how to think about this. So I love the paper's data on labor market contracts, which is really unusual. Normally you have this kind of ex post measurement of labor and firm relationships, but here Tomasz has this cool data on contracts, more of an ex ante measure, which I thought was neat, and I wanted to highlight for people. What I also like, you know, this is the STR and human capital symposium here, and I think so often, and I mean, I myself have this issue, like papers in this area are kind of not necessarily as appealing to the mainstream strategy audience. Like we're all very interested in workers and firms, but oftentimes we're using individual level data and we get more caught up in workers' careers and so on rather than firm strategy and writing things that we might be able to teach in a core strategy class in an MBA program, for example. I think Tomasz's paper is the exact opposite of that. It's very, very focused on very key core strategy topics like centralization, reallocation, acquisitions, productivity, and that was really exciting for me to read the human capital paper that speaks to the mainstream so clearly. So what could we think about here? So Tomasz started framing the paper around chains, which I like. I was going to say the scaling framing to me just wasn't really working. It felt like it was kind of like trying to fit the framing around really cool results, and it wasn't working for me so well. And so I like this idea about chains. And something I was going to suggest, I don't know the nature of your data so well. Another way that you could try to frame this, but again, you should listen to your reviewers and editor more than anything else, is thinking about for-profit firms acquiring nonprofit firms. And a big proviso here is I don't know if the educational institutions that are being acquired are necessarily nonprofit, and they're probably not, which might be why you're framing around chains versus this other kind of profit-nonprofit framing. And if that's the case, then I think going with chains makes a lot of sense. Or you could frame it around, you know, large for-profit firms acquiring smaller firms, like that. If you want to go the profit-nonprofit direction, Vanessa has a really nice paper looking at differences between for-profit and nonprofit hospitals in their misconduct, and that her paper could be a route into this literature that compares profit and for-profit and nonprofit firms or organizations in the strategy world. And I think there's also I think your paper could speak to a really interesting phenomenon that is of concern to a lot of folks, which is how nonprofit and for-profit firms compete with each other and interact. I think most of this concern comes through in healthcare in the United States, where you have this mixture of for-profit and nonprofit hospitals, which, you know, of course, Vanessa's paper is taking advantage of. And I think your results are in a different setting, so they can make them interesting in a way that could speak to this nonprofit for-profit literature with data that are much different than what other folks have been able to find, and also in a different geographic and institutional setting. And so this is an architectural change, you know, in the spirit of Henderson and Clark. It's not so modular; it's more architectural. So I kind of cringe to offer it, but I think I like the direction Tomasz is going, looking at chain ownership right now, and I wanted to just emphasize that and again say I'm happy to chat more if I can help the authors with anything. And with that, I'll wrap up and happy to hang around for a little bit for questions. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Seth, and great comments. And you have to tell me how you get onto the slide. Video. Wonderful. All right. Thank you. That's the end of the consortium. Thank you so much for all the great comments, for the presenters, for the great discussion, for all of the comments in the chat as well. And looking forward to seeing you all at the next and the upcoming virtual symposium, which is going to be on corporate strategy, which is going to be in April. So thank you so much. Hope you enjoy the rest of the day, and good night for those of you who are in Asia.